Elliot Abrams has had a very exciting and varied career in the sense of tapping in at several levels of government. In a sense, he began his career at Harvard and earned the AB and the JD degree there, and then a Master's of Science degree in economics from London School of Economics. Initially, then, he practiced law in the firm of Breed, Abbott, and Morgan in New York, and then became assistant counsel to the United States Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigation. He served with Senator Jackson as special counsel, and then special counsel and chief of staff to Senator Pat Moynihan. Then he returned to the practice of law, and following that joined the Reagan administration in three capacities. First, as Assistant Secretary for International Organization Affairs in the Department of State. Secondly, as Assistant Secretary for Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs. And lastly, as Assistant Secretary for Inter-American Affairs. Since leaving the government, he's been a senior scholar at the Hudson Institute in Washington and is writing a book. We feel it's very appropriate as we try to explore the Reagan presidency in our little oral history here that we have an opportunity to visit with Secretary Abrams, and he'll make a brief statement and then be available for questions.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, be back in Charlottesville. It's particularly nice to drive down at this time of year. This subject is so broad that I thought I would just make one comment, in a sense, to get the ball rolling. Looking at the questions that you sent and thinking about them, about Reagan as president, Reagan's leadership, I'm reminded of a statement that a State Department official, now Ambassador to Poland, Tom Simons, makes in his book, which came out about a month ago, about U.S. foreign policy in the 80s. Pardon me. He calls Reagan a mysterious man. And I think there's a lot to that. Mysterious in certain personal ways and mysterious in certain qualities as a leader. It's not that easy, I find, to put your finger on what it was that made him, in my opinion, a very successful president. But as I try to isolate those qualities, one way of looking at it that I found useful was to say this. He was a terrific president and not a terrific prime minister. If we had a system that was a little bit more like the French system, the administration probably would have worked better. Because for a man who was 8 years governor of California and 8 years president, my thought was that he wasn't all that good an executive. You would never have chosen, if you were president, you would never have chosen him to be prime minister in that kind of a system. But he had a different view of what it takes to be president, a view which I think is closer to the truth, and which sees the presidency as not essentially an executive position, but as essentially an inspirational position, as essentially equivalent, well, taking more seriously, I mean, let me put it that way, the notion of being head of state, the notion of being symbolic leader of the people rather than manager of the government's institutions. And he was a lot better at the one than he was at the other, I thought. I want to stop there. There are just a million things to say, but I don't know what order to say them in, so I'll leave that to the questions.
Okay. Who'd like to begin the questions? I might begin. I wondered how much contact any of you at the assistant secretary level had with the president.
In the State Department, those of us who were the five regional assistant secretaries had a reasonable amount of contact, probably because Central America was so hot. I had as much as any, conceivably more. I would say in 86, 87, in particular, I was certainly with him, I'd say, a couple of times a week. Now, let me define with him. I never was alone with the president. I don't think very many people, certainly at my level, were. But we had a lot of meetings that had to do with either Central America or later Panama. That would have been 88. We had National Security Council meetings at which I would attend, with Schultz. Or we had what were known as National Security Planning Group meetings, which were higher level, and which I would attend with Schultz. Or we had lobbying meetings, that is, where you'd have the Senator House leadership, or you'd have one or two or three members of Congress, and the president would be lobbying them. Or you had briefings, or you had state visits and pre-briefs for the state visit, or the dinner or the lunch. And anyway, you add them up, and it came out to an awful lot of meetings. I really never tried to come up with a number, but twice a week's probably not unreasonable.
Did he ever fall asleep in the meetings where you sat?
No, but he was talking in those meetings. Difficult to fall asleep when you're actually speaking. No, he didn't, actually.
So he was, in talking, he took a very active part then.
It varied. I suppose the height came, in some sense, on Central America and Panama, where he really cared a lot about those issues. Though even there it was mixed. I mean, there were some meetings I can recall where he led the conversation, had a very strong position. We'll come back to this on Panama. But he didn't have cards, he didn't have briefings. He knew what he thought, and he very articulately argued with, say, Baker about something. Other meetings, there were some meetings, for example, with foreign leaders where he was not familiar with the issues, and really the cabinet carried the conversation, although I'd have to say, you know, why a president should be deeply familiar with the economic issues we have with Uruguay is beyond me. It's just not that important.
You mentioned Panama. Why would that have been something in which he was seized with a problem?
Panama, to me, is a very interesting issue in taking a look at the Reagan presidency, because it gave rise to some of what I think were really very good moments for the president and some not so good. Let me take the good first. I don't think I ever saw him better in terms of knowledge of the issues, energy, engagement, intelligence, concern, than over what was in a sense a very narrow question. Should we quash the indictment of General Noriega? You may recall that in the spring of 88, we were negotiating with General Noriega about getting him out of power. And it was clear that he wouldn't go if the indictment, he was under indictment, if the drug indictments were not quashed. And the argument in favor of quashing them was, the indictment's a piece of paper, it's not useful, it's not doing anything. If you could trade it for actually getting him out of there, well, that's terrific. The argument against it was it's doing a dirty deal with a drug dealer. It's a terrible blow against the entire drug program. Argument A. Argument B, this is not good for the Bush campaign, a position which concerned the vice president, not least. And there was a lot of arguing. And there was very emotional argument. And in those arguments, you know, Schultz may have stated an argument, but ultimately it came down to an argument between the really Baker speaking for Bush and the president speaking for himself and arguing. And in that sense, it was a high point in that, I never saw the president more aware of all the sides of an argument and more certain of his point of view and you know, sticking to it. Now, the negative side. I would generally say that the Reagan administration, foreign policy anyway, maybe more broadly, was an administration in which contentious issues were supposed to be settled at the cabinet level. I actually remember at one point the then deputy national security advisor, John Edward Ponti, saying at the end of one really contentious session it's been too long, Situation Room, well, we can't take this to the president. We've got to resolve this. And I remember thinking even then, well, what does he get paid for? What do you mean we've got to resolve it? Let him resolve it. That was not the way things were done. That meant that if two cabinet officers could not resolve the question, they would wrangle, and they would wrangle, and they would wrangle, and there was never closure. And that's what happened in Panama. Everybody agreed to have a confrontation with Noriega. Everybody agreed to indict him. Everybody agreed that when he fired President Del Valle in late February of '88, we would not accept this, we would challenge him, we would use tough rhetoric. And then it came time to do something. And you had the State Department saying, let's do something. And you had the Defense Department saying, no. And the president did not adjudicate the question. We had meeting after meeting of the NSC, or the National Security Planning Group, where things got pretty nasty between Schultz and Carlucci, or Schultz and Crow, particularly. The president wouldn't say anything. Now, there is another theory of this, which I think I don't agree with, but it's not, it's a plausible theory, and that is that Schultz actually agreed with the Pentagon, that the president agreed with the Pentagon on inaction, but he didn't want to say to his Secretary of State, you lose. Therefore, he temporized, and as time went by and we did nothing, the Pentagon won by default. I don't think that's right. I think really that this was a case where there were strong arguments on the part of the military and the State Department, and the president just was virtually immobilized by this extremely tough fight among trusted cabinet officers. In that sense, Panama, I think, pointed up a difficulty of the policy-making apparatus.
I don't want to monopolize. One last follow-up. One of your colleagues who met with us said that on some of these issues, and I can't remember if he, I somehow think I remember that he mentioned Panama, that when President Reagan got concerned about a problem, then he did an enormous amount of homework, and that he gave, you can guess who it might have been, he gave some examples from California where the president on a couple of issues really burned every last midnight oil to try to master the detail. Would that distinguish between Panama and some other things, of his mode of operation?
I was not really in a position to judge that. To the extent that I could, I would disagree with that. Mm-hmm. I think what changed in respect to, say, Central America or Panama was, first of all, the president remembered everything that was told to him. His memory was, in a sense, selective, and he didn't remember things he didn't care about. I can remember telling him anecdotes about Central America that he would then use with a congressman 3 months later. So when he cared, he absorbed it all. And he could get briefed and then turn around and give that briefing back. But I would not have said that, you know, that he was sitting around at night reading histories of Panama.
Henry Theobard?
We have heard from several people that, speaking of the cabinet was really didn't function as a cabinet in a conventional sense. When you got away from the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, and Secretary of Treasury, the rest of them are more or less, from a cabinet standpoint, honorary jobs, as it were, and they had very little working function except responsibilities for their own department. Would you say that that was as you saw it?
That is the way I saw it, but of course I was looking from the State Department. I don't know, for example, how they handled housing policy or take economic policy. I would, you know, I don't know what role, say, the Commerce Secretary played in that, or the U.S. Trade Representative. Certainly, from the foreign policy point of view, they had no role. Occasionally, you did have a role for the U.S. Trade Representative.
Yes, Bill Wemple.
I've always found it surprising that we would indict Noriega, a foreign head of state who hadn't even been in this country, under our law, as opposed to try him under our law. And I would have supposed that there would have been a lot of legal and political argument against the indictments, and then having been brought in favor of dismissing them, unless they having been done, having been indicted, there was a great deal of concern that dismissing them might have, as I think you suggested, some unfortunate political repercussions for Vice President Bush and his prospects.
Well, first, I don't think there's any trouble here legally. Noriega was periodically in the United States, and under the sort of classic long arm idea criminal jurisprudence, you don't even really have to set foot in a state. That is, if you're in Florida in order for a murder to be committed, well, that's what he was doing. And so legally, I don't think there was any difficulty at all. Now, politically, that's a different question. And we were aware that, generally speaking, this was not done. And it was not done for, in a sense, for the same reason that we don't assassinate foreign leaders. That is, that once you start going down that road, you're going to end up regretting it. You're going to end up with worrying about the ability of the president himself to travel. Where does it stop? We did it anyway for a mixture of reasons. First, we thought, you know, he's not an elected leader. After all, he isn't the president of Panama. At no time did he even claim to be president of Panama. He was a high foreign official, but he was not a head of state. So he didn't get the head of state exception. And he was, we thought, a criminal. That is, we weren't going after him for a crime tinged with politics, for example, for holding political prisoners, or for not allowing a free press or something, but for a purely criminal act, drug trafficking. However, there was also politics in this. We in Washington did not invent the idea of indicting Noriega. The idea of indicting Noriega was invented by two U.S. attorneys in Florida, whom we, at least in the State Department, suspected of all wanting to be the next governor of Florida. Once somebody comes along and says, let's indict Noriega, you got a problem. do you want to be the guy who appears on the front page of the Washington Post the following day saying no? A small aside, I once asked for a 1 week delay in the indictment of a Haitian official for drug trafficking. 1 week delay, because we were 3 days before the Haitian elections, and I thought, why take the risk of upsetting the elections? Do it after the elections. And I called the Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division, who is now the governor, about to be the governor of Massachusetts, and I said, is there a reason we can't wait a week? No. Let's wait a week. Fine. Well, the next morning, I read in the Washington Post that I was blocking the indictment of a drug trafficker. So that, I think, that happened in the case of Noriega, too. We actually had a meeting, and, you know, about this many people in a room this size, and we went around and said, all right, now, they're going to do this unless anyone, State Department, Defense Department, CIA, and anybody here, we went around the room, do you object? And no one did. And it occurred to me as I was sitting there that some of the people who might actually have thought it were a very dumb idea were not raising their hands because they were afraid of leaks. Then we indicted him. Now, once he was indicted, we had this entirely new problem. And here I have to say, we blew it. This was a mistake on my part and that of others in the administration. I did not believe that the indictment itself would become an issue in American politics and a big deal in the Reagan administration. I thought, what is the downside? It's a chip. You trade it. You bargain with it. Sure, he won't like being indicted. Sure, it puts him in a corner. So it's just something else to bargain with when it's time to get him out of there. And you quash the indictment if you can't do anything about it. And that seemed to be the general view. It turned out, of course, that the indictment had a life of its own. It became a big political factor, or at least it was thought to be. The argument was that it would undercut the entire anti-drug program, that a lot of people would accuse the vice president of a cover-up. That is, we quashed the indictment because Noriega knew things that he would tell about the vice president. We missed that. We didn't think it would become a domestic political issue. I remember asking Cheney, who was then congressman from Wyoming. He was in Wyoming at this time. And I said to him, what's the attitude out there? He said, oh, everybody's against quashing the indictment. And I said, why? I don't get it. If we can use it to get rid of Noriega. And he said, they don't care about Noriega. Who rules Panama is of relatively little significance to people in Wyoming. Doing deals in the American judicial context with drug dealers, quashing American indictments, they don't like that. And I should finish this by saying, in the end, though, the president decided to do it. The fact that we didn't do it was because Noriega would not sign, make an agreement with us. The president actually, after long argument, overruled the vice president, Baker. Meese was against it as well, and said, I'll do it if that's what it takes to get an agreement.
Victor Yonke.
Mr. Secretary, I think it was Duvalier, the head of Haiti, or the United States administration or State Department, or someone was able to lean on the French to accept Duvalier, and that was fairly clean and fairly simple. Did you have a difficulty getting the Spaniards to accept Noriega at all? I mean, then the invasion of Panama would have been necessary?
I don't think it's fair to say we tricked the French. The French agreed to take Duvalier with the view that he would move along and that we would help them find a place for him. We did, in fact, do an unbelievable survey. I think we asked about 30 countries to take Duvalier off the hands of the French. Nobody would do it. So there he sits. Noriega was easy. Oddly enough, the Spanish came to us. The timing must have been around the end of the summer of 87 before he'd been indicted, but when it was clear the relations with him were worsening. Gonzalez was in Washington. I don't think that's right. But somebody from Gonzalez's office was in Washington and said, look, we'll take him. We have a tradition. We took Batista and Perón and... it's not political. This is a contribution we can make to
This dog is running around outside.
Not mine.
Put him in my office. It's good enough for my dog, I guess.
He said, we have a tradition of helping the evolution of democracy in Latin America by taking dictators off their hands, and we'll take them. He wouldn't go. The problem was Noriega, not the Spanish. He, of course, ultimately there was no deal, but when we were negotiating with him, he ruled Spain out on the grounds that he didn't know anyone there, it was too far. He wanted to go to, I guess, the Dominican Republic, which we thought was too close. But he had a daughter who'd married a Dominican general, and he owned property in Dominican Republic. So the Spanish were willing, but Noriega wasn't.
Next question. Yes, Arthur Stocker.
Mr. Secretary, Mr. Reagan seems to have been at least as much interested in the Comcast in Nicaragua as he was in Panama.
Yes.
To what extent would you say that the Iran-Comcast situation was influenced by the desire to get money for the Comcast, and to what extent by the desire to accomplish diplomatic ends of one sort or another in the Middle East?
Well, this is a big question. let me start. I really could have started the whole discussion this way, but
you're familiar with it.
let me start with one comment, which I think is quite debatable. Seems to me that the one of the greatest mistakes the Reagan administration made in all 8 years was to try to achieve its goals in Nicaragua on the cheap. I think that was the fundamental mistake with respect to Nicaragua. The view that we were not going to accept the Sandinista control of Nicaragua as permanent, as fixed, as the equivalent of Cuba now, another Cuba, was clear in the president's mind, I think, before he became president. He felt very strongly about that. We were going to do some. First of all, we were going to stop the FMLN in El Salvador. And secondly, we were going to do something about those Sandinistas. We were going to get them somehow or other. Well, how? I think the administration made a huge mistake. I have to say, for the sake of the historical record here, this is before my time. with 2020 hindsight, it's easy for me to say this. It's not so easy to say what my advice would have been in 1981. But the administration, instead of taking on the Congress and public opinion, dove under. Stage one of diving under was to hand it over to the CIA. Stage two, when that became impossible due to the Boland Amendment, was to dive deeper and do it in an organization that was theoretically more secret than the CIA, that was off the books. But it would have been a mistake even if you'd stopped at the CIA. It was a mistake to define something as a very important security matter and then do it covertly. If it's that important, if this is critical, if Central America is important to our security, and so on, as the president repeatedly said, then it really deserved not to be shunted aside as a matter for 30 guys in the CIA to handle or not handle. I think, to me, one of the great mysteries of the Reagan administration is precisely Casey's role in all of this. When the real buildup began in Nicaragua, in the fall of 86, October, I think, we got the $100 million. And we began to build an army, which ultimately came close to 20,000 men. And I remember saying to Secretary Shultz right at the beginning of this, you know, this is a mistake. CIA doesn't know how to run armies. This is a military operation. This isn't covert anymore. Nor is it, you know, this is an army, and it should be run by our army. When you have, for example, 20,000 men, you have logistical problems. They're very serious. There are
hundreds and hundreds of colonels who've made it their life's work to know how to handle logistical problems. There aren't that many guys in the CIA. And I went on and on with what I thought was an extremely persuasive argument, comparing the strengths and weaknesses of the two institutions with enormous perceptivity. And when I finished, he smiled, Secretary Shultz smiled and said, yeah, but Cap won't touch it with a 10-foot pole and Bill Casey wants it, so that's how it's going to be. Political science at work. That's how it was. The relationship, when I talked about the mystery, of course, I meant the relationship between North and Casey, which I guess we will not ever really know for sure. I don't think that I don't think that the two operations were initially linked. That is, there was a view that we should try to have a relationship with Iran. This was a view that was held by a number of people. For example, Don Fortier, who was at that time Deputy National Security Advisor, had the view, and I think, you know, looking at it in November 1990, it was clearly a correct view, that we were tilting too far to Iraq. That there was not in the long run interest of the United States to do that, and that we should see if it were possible to redress the balance. That strategic view was correct. And Fortier around that time developed cancer and died at the age, I think, of 42. Had he lived, perhaps that Iran issue would not have gone crazy and would have been more useful. Separately, there was, of course, the desire to keep the Contras going. After the congressional cutoff, there were a number of ways that was done. One of the ways was the legal and authorized way. That is, we tried to get some foreign governments to give money. The Saudis had done so, and we tried to get others to do so. The link between this secret Iran effort and the Contras, I think, was not part of the original plan, and I don't know who invented it. I think that North claims that he invented it. I don't know, maybe Casey invented it. But that came later, and the two projects would have existed even without that link.
Thank you.
Next question. Yes, George.
I'd like to ask a question of a general nature, if I may. Since World War II, some of the presidents have had difficulty in relating to the American public as to political policy and military policy as to when they're the same and when they are separated. Would you care to hazard some comments on that, please?
Let me make a comment about Reagan. I think this is about one-third on the point that you raised. I think one of the reasons why there has been this apparent gap in the way presidents have handled that question is there has been a gap between the role which our policy of containment caused us to play in the world and the role the American people were willing to accept. The original policy was sold as a cheap policy. I don't think an effort was made to mislead the American people. People thought it was cheap. I'm struck. In 47, Acheson, testifying before the Senate, was asked whether we would have a permanent troop presence in Europe. And he said, no. Absolutely not. Not even contemplated. The heart of the plan for Europe was the Marshall Plan, not the military side until rather later, North Atlantic Treaties 49. So initially, the containment policy was not supposed to be one which required large army wars and so forth. And every time the containment policy got us into a war, it seems to me, there was an almost Newtonian reaction against it. In a sense, I think you could say that the reaction against Korea was not only the defeat of the Democrats, but the Doctrine of Massive Retaliation, where a president said, yes, we're going to stop communism, and no soldier will get hurt because of it. We're just going to nuke them. It's cost-free. And I take that as an effort to match the requirements of containment policy with the real reluctance on the part of the American people to get involved in 1,000 fights all over the place. I think that the same thing can be said of the Nixon Doctrine, which in a sense was a reaction to Vietnam. And Vietnam also destroyed a presidency. And then a new president comes in, and how is it that he is going to deal with the Soviet menace and containment? Well, the Shah will do it for us. We don't have to fight. We're having more wars. I think, to get to Reagan, that the Reagan Doctrine was the same, served the same basic purpose. Reagan believed that the Soviets had gone very far forward in the 70s, in the late 70s, from Nicaragua to Afghanistan to Iran. It had been a period of Soviet advances. How are we going to deal with this? Guerrillas. Again, your son won't have to fight. We're not going to be involved in any war. Rather, the Contras and Savimbi and the Afghan rebels, people like that, will do it for us. An effort, in a sense, not to raise the level of public willingness to engage in military action, but an effort to persuade the public that we could accomplish everything we needed to accomplish without it. And in a sense, this is, in my mind at least, related to the comment I made before that he tried to do Nicaragua on the cheap, because it was necessary to do it on the cheap. It's part of the Reagan Doctrine to show people that we could do all this without getting into any wars.
To what extent might that have stemmed from his political success domestically in California with an opposition legislature? He had proven his political mettle, hadn't he, in adverse political circumstances. Did he transfer that to foreign policy, do you think? And I thought that there were ways of finessing some of these things without maximum price.
I don't know. I think it is true. I wasn't with him in California, but I think it is true from everything I've seen that he came to Washington with a view of the legislative branch that was negative, and the view that in a sense they should butt out of foreign policy. Just a bad attitude towards the role of Congress in foreign policy. I think also that there was a reluctance to spend the political capital. I think this was particularly visible in the 84 campaign, when a lot of Republicans said, what is the purpose of this? Is the purpose of this to get the best landslide, or is it the purpose to advance certain policy views? there was, I think, a reluctance to take actions that clearly were going to be costly on the political side.
Next question.
There's someone behind you, too.
Yes, sure. Alan Parra.
The Reagan administration was always critical of the link that was made between human rights and military aid. And I'm curious to know what you think about with the rise of power tomorrow in Nicaragua. Do you think it's more viable to make that link with respect to Osama bin Laden?
Well, yeah, I would disagree with your premise first, that the administration always took the view that human rights and military aid should not be linked. We had a different view of it than the Carter administration. We felt that in some cases they had insisted on that in a sense for symbolic purposes, and had forgotten that some of the countries in question really had difficult military situations. We thought that our case was proved, in a sense, before we got in, because in January of 81, just the last 3 weeks of the Carter administration, Carter had in fact started shipping arms to the Salvadoran junta again, one of the least attractive governments in the period, because they needed it. I would say that to start. Secondly, I'd say the policy changed. There really wasn't a human rights policy in the first year. You had the Lefebvre hearings, which went on until May, I think, roughly, more or less, went on for a few months. And that left the administration in disarray, of there being nobody in the job. And you also had, on the part of some people, maybe the president, certainly Jean Kirkpatrick, a kind of visceral feeling that this whole bit, this whole thing called human rights was bad. It was something the Democrats had invented. And we weren't going to have any part of it. And it really took a while. It took two things, I think, to get any kind of human rights policy. The first was me, and the second was George Shultz. I took that job in December of 81, and it took a while for us to get our doctrine straight. That is, we actually had to write it. We had to think it and write it. We being really Charles Fairbanks, who's now at Johns Hopkins, and I, try to figure out what would a Reaganite human rights policy look like. How would you handle Chile and Paraguay, South Africa, Korea, Turkey? But Haig wasn't much interested. That was the second problem. I think I may be being slightly unfair to him, but it's indicative that I think it's only slight, that he really felt human rights was kind of a foolish subject.
Didn't he say fighting terrorism was a better alternative?
Yes. I mean, his thinking was not clear about this at all, and he was just basically negative about it. Shultz had a very different view, a essentially non-ideological view. He thought, well, human rights, sure, of course, we're for human rights. What precisely would you like us to do in this case, and let's see whether it's reasonable. So he came in the summer of 82, and by the end of 82, the Human Rights Bureau was really in business because we had the year of the secretary. That was a big change.
Could I push you just a little on this? The good Elliot Abrams for the whole country, liberals and conservatives, is your human rights period. Nobody, at least that I know, we had several dissertations here from people of different views. Nobody was very critical of that. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more of how you functioned in that period. Who were your allies? What did the president think about human rights?
We started from scratch in a sense that the Bureau was in complete disarray. In the State Department, you know, the important bureaus are the regional ones. The what are known as functional bureaus, drugs, UN, human rights, economics, have a hard time gaining any territory. And the Human Rights Bureau is probably the weakest of all. And it didn't have the secretary's ear. The first thing we did was to try to get some good people in the Bureau. And try to figure out what we thought. And we did some essays, we did some cables that partly theoretical and partly by looking at cases that existed in Poland. Remember, Let Poland Be Poland? That was the era of that stuff. Turkey, as well as Central America. Chile, Guatemala, were all issues back in 82. Once Shultz became secretary, it became possible to make an argument. Let me divide the countries into two groups. There are countries that are relatively unimportant, and therefore the State Department is allowed to be in charge of them. And then there are countries that other agencies have a piece of. For example, Chile, Paraguay, and Haiti are State Department countries. whereas Panama, of course, is a country with DOD, Philippines, where DOD had a lot to say. Some kind of treasury has a lot to say. In the countries that were really ours, if you will, you just had to persuade Schultz. We started developing a human rights policy toward Chile by talking to him about what we thought should be a greater distancing from and opposition to Pinochet. Guatemala too, around this time, remember there was a question as to whether we should be in favor of arms for the Guatemalan army. One point that I do want to make is that when a new secretary comes in, all you need to do is win one or two battles. After that, everybody understands that you don't elevate every issue to the secretary, and that they might lose if an issue is elevated. So then you can bargain, and then you can bargain about the text of cables and about conditions and so forth. That happened with Schultz. Now the president's role. First, the president had just instantaneous grasp of the desirability of having an active, positive human rights policy. He didn't like the constant kind of harping at people. He didn't like the constant criticizing people who were, after all, for the most part, pro-American. He didn't mind doing that with Castro. But when you're talking about countries like Korea or Turkey, it displeased him to have to do this. What he did like very much, and what he saw the value of, a lot of people who should have known better didn't, was things like the National Endowment for Democracy. The idea that actually trying to help the evolution of democracy was important. We argued doctrinally that we should move from casework, that is, get Mr. A out of jail and reopen newspaper B, to systemic change, because only those systemic changes would guarantee that the one or two gains you made would remain, and that all the political prisoners would be free. Well, that fit very nicely with the president's instincts, which were that he did not want to be smacking his friends all the time. What he wanted to do was to figure out a way to help, a positive attitude. So it all fit together very nicely. And that was that speech to Westminster that actually Mark Palmer, now ambassador, ex-ambassador to Hungary, no longer, largely wrote, which was the beginnings of the National Endowment for Democracy. The president did not intervene in human rights policy of Chile. We had what we thought was a very good policy about Chile. Schultz cared about it, arguing that we were being too critical of Pinochet and threatening to take things to the president. And on several occasions, we actually had to compromise because we just were not sure. There was a moment, I was not at this meeting, but I remember there was a meeting at which, I think I was out of town, Chile was discussed. And one of my deputies went, deputy for South America went, and the president at one point in discussion said if he could just talk to Pinochet, maybe he could get him to change some of the things he was doing, and maybe we should invite him to Washington, at which Schultz apparently vaulted out of his seat and said, don't even think about it. On the positive policy, the president was gung-ho. On the negative policy, he was dubious. And we had to be careful that we were not getting out in front of him. The worst failure was the Philippines, our worst failure in the Human Rights Bureau. I'm not the person to discuss the evolution of U.S. policy towards the Philippines, but it apparently pained the president to have to tell Marcos to go. And early on, he was a great friend. And in 80, around 84, I suspect it was, there was a great state visit of Marcos to Washington. And it was awful. I mean, I do not believe the words human rights were ever mentioned to him. And the president didn't want to. The president didn't want to have a difficult time with his friend.
Is it possible that what Ambassador Barnes argues, that human rights worked in Chile because freedom, which the president fervently believed in, was linked with human rights and was more difficult to link in other places, perhaps, like the Philippines? Explains that difference or not?
I would tend to disagree. I think there's an element of truth in it. Certainly, one question was, what's next? And though Pinochet claimed that, you know, what's next is chaos, that was a foolish argument, and no one who really knew Chile believed it. In the Philippines, it was easier to make the argument that Marcos would not be followed by real democracy. There's an element of truth to that. I think it was more personal than that. I think the president believed the Carter administration had beat up American friends, and that was bad as a matter of theory. And he knew some of these people. I mean, it's one thing to say Pinochet, whom we'd never met, but he knew Marcos and presumably liked Marcos. And the idea that the relationship with Marcos should be soured by harping on this, he wasn't buying. But I think it was pretty personal.
Was Weinberger an ally on human rights?
Really irrelevant, I think. I suppose that if we had tried to push very hard against countries that were really militarily important, like Turkey and the Philippines, if we got past the White House, we'd have met the Defense Department. And we did in Panama. When we started pushing against Noriega and tried to start in 85, it was DOD that blocked it.
Other questions?
Bill Webb. I wanted to ask whether you have another question.
Why don't we let John and then Bill?
Mine's a little more future-oriented. I'd be very interested to know how you contrast the Bush administration's Latin American policy with the Reagan administration's policy. I know, for example, that Bush was going to be going to South America in the first week in December to meet with the Argentine and Brazilian presidents. The emphasis seems to be in the Bush administration a lot of emphasis on economic issues, economic integration, free trade issues. Do you see a sharp distinction, I guess, and if so, where?
Well, I see a sharp distinction mostly because it's a different world. We came to office in a world which was so difficult in Central America that Jimmy Carter himself had torn apart and thrown away his entire Latin American policy in his last weeks in office, aiding the Salvadoran junta and cutting aid to the Sandinistas. We thought we had, again, I was not personally involved this time, I certainly agree. Step one, you know, is stop the fall of El Salvador. I mean, we thought we had a real security issue in what we maybe let's call the Caribbean Basin, because you also had Grenada, which at that time was under Bishop, and heading south. And we did not want another Nicaragua. We felt these were serious security issues. And, you know, you have to think back into 1980. It'd been a pretty good period for the Russians. Furthermore, Mexico was not in good shape. Mexico was run by a thief who was destroying the economy. And he was not the first person to meet those qualifications. So the whole region seemed to us to be very troublesome from a security point of view. And our main concern was the security angle, which meant that that we paid most attention to the Caribbean Basin rather than South America. More or less by the time Bush came in, those problems were passed without addressing the issue of why, you know, whether it was Reagan or whether it was Gorbachev, whatever. The security problem was largely solved, or and it was declining, it was not growing. And I think it was therefore possible for the president to turn toward what logic would suggest. Logic would suggest something that we understood, Reagan understood, which is Mexico is critical. And in fact, we had paid a lot of attention to Mexico. The trouble is that when Mexico is going in the wrong direction, there's almost nothing we can do about it. When Mexico begins to go in the right direction, then we can really help a lot. And when they ask for help, Salinas asked for help, well, De La Madrid too, they got a fair amount of help. And Bush followed on, built on that, built a terrific relationship with Salinas. So that was a very smart thing to do. The second smart thing to do is, again, to say, well, where are the people and where's the money? And the answer is South America. The answer is Brazil, Argentina, countries like that, Venezuela and Colombia. And so he built some personal relationships with the presidents and began to pay somewhat more attention to South America. I think that is, well, one comment. That can only be done when the situation closer to home is essentially in hand. Although, don't forget, they paid an awful lot of attention to Panama until that one was solved, but essentially in hand. Secondly, though, and to show I did work for Alexander Haig, one caveat. There's less than meets the eye. If you were to talk to Carlos Andres Perez, you'd find that he did not feel himself to be a great friend of President Reagan's, but feels himself to be a great friend of President Bush's. You have to be a pretty cynical Washington dweller to use the term friend to describe the relationship between them, or between the president and any Latin leader. Stylistically, he has a much better style than Reagan in dealing with many of the Latin presidents, and gives them a very, really very warm and appreciated feeling, which is politically quite useful. But, you know, what are we doing for Venezuela? Not much. How significantly have the Brady Plan was invented in the Reagan administration? What has it accomplished? Well, Mexico. But of course, Mexico is kind of special. I think the test is going to be if the, particularly if the president has two terms, so he's got six more years, the test is going to be whether this initiative for the Americas takes off. It's very striking to me that you can search the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal from month to month to find a mention of this initiative for the Americas. It is daily fodder in the Latin press, literally daily. They think about it and care about it, and if the president can really build on that and begin to get, for example, trade agreements, that's a historic accomplishment. Let me try to say this much more briefly. Before you could have a North American free trade zone, before you could have concentration on Mexico and South America, you had to settle the security issues. Reagan did that, and Bush intelligently now builds on it.
You want to ask any question on non-proliferation?
No. I'll say that.
I'm an expert on this. Bill Wemple.
I wonder if the presence or absence of the military draft makes as much of a political difference as I have sometimes supposed. I think it was the draft, I guess you might say, demolished Lyndon Johnson. Its absence may perhaps explain why there's been so comparatively little agitation and loud controversy about our build-up in the Gulf. But I guess really we don't have any idea of what the net of that is unless and until some shooting starts. But I did have a feeling that the absence of the draft is maybe an important factor in the fact that the Gulf buildup will seem to go with comparatively little loud noise and controversy as yet.
The question is, what effect does the absence of the draft, what might the absence of the draft have on our policies.
First, I agree. I think it's hard to measure, but it seems that it made the use of force easier for presidents by diminishing the domestic debate about that decision. However, this gives me a chance to say, you know, Reagan was not much of a guy for using force. It's odd, I mean, in the sense that he has this kind of image as a very tough guy and carrying a big stick and so forth. But what did he actually do? He was quite careful. I mean, he had a, you know, Grenada, which was a one-day deal. He would not do Panama. He refused to do Panama. He just didn't want it. And that was, you know, it's a lot bigger than Grenada, but it wasn't that large an operation. The Marine, maybe he was scared off in part by what happened in Beirut, which was such a disaster, such a tragedy. But I am struck by that fact, that he was really quite loath to use American military. Now, why? I can only make two guesses. One temperament, that he did not like doing it. He did not like sending people off to die. Secondly, advisors. President really did rely on advisors a lot. And he had in Weinberger someone who you may recall invented a set of rules which would have made it difficult to have the American Revolution. they, you know, Weinberger was I was of the school of conservatives who by the end was beginning to turn against the military budget on the grounds that they clearly felt these arms were too valuable ever to be used. Crow felt the same way, and Crow was an impressive figure. Physically impressive figure, and argued, for example, Crow may be the single largest reason nothing was done in Panama in the Reagan administration. But the president valued and listened to his advisors, and the fact that his key military advisors were against using force, I think, had a large impact also.
Using hindsight, what is your opinion about the Panama Canal Treaty on the giveback?
Oh boy. this is perhaps an odd thing to say, but I really have very mixed views. I still don't like it emotionally. On balance, I think it was probably the right thing to do, and that it will turn out all right. I don't take it for granted that we're going to give the canal back to Panama. Certainly, if they get themselves another Noriega or not. And I don't care who's president. I just think that suppose, for example, that it had been a 10-year treaty instead of a 20-year treaty, perfectly plausible. That 10 years would have been up in the middle of Noriega, and we weren't going to give the canal back to Noriega. So, in a sense, the canal treaty, I don't say that critically, because one of the things that it does is to give the Panamanians an incentive for development of a decent and democratic government in Panama to take it. I would bet, I think it's probable, and I think also that they will... that they'll run the canal reasonably. What I'd like to see happen, actually, is some kind of setting up of a public corporation in which the Panama government only owns 51%, and then you could run it, maybe the Japanese and the United States invest, and then you could run it on a more independent, non-political, commercial basis.
There's no law against graduate students asking a question. Do any of you want to ask questions? Jim?
If I could go back to your comments on containment strategy and the whole idea in the Reagan administration, the Reagan doctrine being containment on the cheap.
Yeah.
I guess I found that paradoxical, because conventional wisdom would say that Reagan's defense policy was anything but containment on the cheap as a whole. Do you think there were two tracks in the containment policy of Ronald Reagan, one for the third world and another that was east-west?
Not exactly. No, I guess no. I think what I'd say is that in American political terms, you get elected in November 80, you come to office January 81. A defense, building up your defenses is cheap politically. Carter was going to do it. I mean, Carter's forward budgets had called for a significant military buildup. There was a consensus on the Hill that, yeah, we had to do some. Obviously not as much as Reagan wanted, and he pushed up the totals a lot. But it wasn't that hard. And in terms of what did it cost him in domestic political popularity, very little. Whereas, dead soldiers, that's a serious matter politically as well as morally. So I would say no. I think it you know, big military budgets are a cheap way. Now, I think Reagan did this with, you know, with malice aforethought with respect to the Soviets. I think that part of the idea was spend them into the ground, and it worked. So I think with respect to the Soviets, it really, there was a plan there. It was both defensive in the sense that they'd been spending a lot and we needed to improve the readiness of the military, but also there was an idea that in this spending race, they were going to go under. I don't know that anybody really believed they'd go under quite as dramatically as they have. But I would stick with the view that the idea was to get somebody else to do your fighting for you. By the way, I don't think it is at all surprising that we have a complete vacuum now in explanations of what we're doing in Iraq, because according to my theory, you know, we've been trying to do this on the cheap for decades. And now all of a sudden, it isn't even a matter of fighting the Russians, which at least is a clear enemy. Now people, thousands of people may have to die. And the Cold War is over. So it is not so easy to explain to the American people. What is the theory under which soldiers have to die in this case? When they didn't even have to die when the Russians were around. Now, that's an exaggeration, because we lost tens of thousands in both Korea and Vietnam, which were Cold War wars. But you know, I think the point still stands.
You've begun to answer my follow-up question, and that is, do you think that the Bush defense policy and that switching to a policy where I think we're going to start to see some cutbacks in the monetary figures as far as what we're willing to pay for defense, but we may end up paying more in lives for defense. Do you think this is a reaction to the defense policy of Ronald Reagan? In terms of the monetary costs?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think it's a different problem, mm-hmm. Which is that the bipolar structure was in fact a structure, and it assigned everybody a place, and everybody, every position was a position relative to the two superpowers. And there were constraints on freedom of action for every other player because of their relationship with the superpower or because of the interests of a superpower. And there was a structure there, and it collapsed. Mm-hmm. And you now have actors. I think what's bizarre about it, not bizarre, that's not the right word. What is new about it is that the security problems come from minor countries. I mean, in a sense, this is really quite new. Go back to the revolution. I mean, what'd you worry about? British Empire, French Empire, Spanish Empire, perfectly logical, most powerful forces in the world. And in the 19th century, you have Germany and Japan growing. In the 20th century, the Soviet Union. That's what you worry about, the most powerful countries. Now we don't worry about the most powerful countries much. I mean, we're not going to have a war with the Soviets or the Germans or the Japanese. But we're worried about relatively minor countries, and we don't quite know how to deal with those countries yet, and it's gotten away from us. And this was a mistake of the Reagan administration, the letting Iraq, in a sense, get so heavily armed, although I think it was then really a tremendous diplomatic failure of the Bush administration to have given this heavily armed Iraq the impression it could take Kuwait for free.
That's right.
Other questions? Yes.
Yeah.
I don't remember hearing in the first half of the 40s, 80s, very much about the defense spending policy, the buildup of the defense budget, that it was intended to put pressure on the Soviet economy. I don't recall hearing that articulated in any way, shape, or form of any significance. Do you remember that being brought forth in the public arena?
Certainly not in the early years. No,
right, let me add to it a bit. Also, in corollary to that, I don't think that we accepted the estimates of how weak the economy of the Soviet Union really was. And many, many people in the private side knew how weak it was, but that was not accepted in the high policy circles or articulated by the president. There you are. I guess you
I think you're right on both halves. Well, it's a great, interesting question as to why, for example, the U.S. government, particularly CIA estimates of the Soviet economy, were so positive. No, I don't think anybody expected, and perhaps I misspoke in giving this impression, that we could spend the Soviets into oblivion. But rather, I think when the argument was made, then people would say, well, it's a good thing anyway, because if we spend a lot and they spend a lot, they're poorer than we, and it'll hurt them more. The argument in the early 80s was a preparedness argument. In fact, I heard a speech by Cap Weinberger about 2 weeks ago in which he reviewed this and said, I don't remember the data, but you know that the we had all sorts of equipment that didn't work. We had no spare parts. We were really not ready. That was the main idea.
That's what I remember. Yeah. I don't remember the other side at all.
Other questions? You used the word adjudicate, the particular disputes. We've interviewed a couple of the principals and hope to interview one or two more, including your boss. What were the principal? If you were framing an oral history, what questions would you ask Weinberger and Schultz about their relationships and
the relationship between the two
between the two of them?
Well, I came to this relationship in a sense late. In the Human Rights Bureau, you didn't see much of Weinberger. Then I did. And it was clear that the relationship between them was poisonous. There was no hiding it. I mean, at these situation room meetings, they just, this is going to sound like not too much, but given who was president and the collegial nature of the group, they really went over the line into direct face-to-face impoliteness, which was just something that never happened in cabinets, and the sarcasm and the they used towards each other and the body language, just you didn't want to get between that between the two of them. And the staffs essentially carried on this fight, committing guerrilla warfare against each other. I think one question, I've never actually asked Schultz or Weinberger if they would agree with this idea of mine that things broke down because of that. That is, the president didn't like adjudicating between two guys he liked and trusted, and that things hit a lot of standoffs because the president wouldn't decide. I'd be interested to know if they agree. I'd be interested to know also what they think were the cases in which in which they came up against each other most clearly. What were the cases? I mean, there were some issues like arms control, but if there were particular cases, though, others might give you examples of those that the secretaries need to be asked about. Another question would be, the impact, if any, of that relationship on national security advisors and the impact of national security advisors on the relationship. I think, you know, looking back, one is really quite struck at the weakness of the national security advisors that Reagan had. You know, why? Particularly for a president who really relies on advisors. I can understand Bush having a weak national security advisor if he would say, well, look, I know this stuff, this is my field, I can do this. It might be wrong, but it wouldn't be shocking. But it is really quite surprising in the case of Reagan. I guess the answer that suggests itself is, well, the cabinet secretaries took care of that one. And in fact, from the very beginning, it was clear that Haig viewed Dick Allen as someone who was there to be destroyed. You know, this was a target practice. There was not to be an independent foreign policy voice in the White House. Haig liked, I guess he had worked with Scowcroft, and in a sense that was his model, that it was a staff guy, period. Then you had Clark. But there wasn't, now where it worked, I think, is somebody like Powell, where he really could help blunt the sharp edges, and he really could, to the extent that he gave an independent view, he did it, he did it very carefully, let me say that, but he did it in a way that did not offend the secretaries. I mean, it was a system that required somebody of enormous bureaucratic skill. The other guys didn't have it. And Carlucci, maybe, but Carlucci wasn't in the job all that long, the NSC job. It certainly, I guess, ground up national security advisors, but they also, because of the people who were chosen for that job, were not generally in a position to help solve this, to me, in the administration. I remember... this is not a major event in the administration, but it's an example. There was a peace plan agreed upon by the Sandinistas and the other presidents. This was not with the Contras, that came later. And I remember sitting in Schultz's office. It was later and later and later. It was a Friday night. We all wanted to go home. It was just Schultz and me and Phil Habib. And it came in, and the more I read, the more horrified I was. I thought it was just awful. And the more Phil liked it. And finally, we got page 27, or whatever the last page was. And he read it and said, I think we've got it. Meaning we've got what we need to have peace in the region. And I read the last page and thought, ah, disaster. And Phil said to the secretary, I'll go tomorrow. I'll go down to Central America tomorrow, I'll visit all the presidents. And I thought that was a really bad idea. And I said to the secretary, that is a really bad idea. But Schultz disagreed. And told the president that Phil should go down. And this was probably, I don't know when this was, I think Weinberger was still secretary, and Carlucci was national security advisor. Well, Weinberger was against it, and there was an actual White House meeting the next day at which Schultz, Weinberger, Carlucci, the president, I was not there, but many bootleg versions of this circulated, and Weinberger said, Habib should not be allowed to travel down there. And now, you know, in a sense, this was not his business, which must have infuriated Schultz to begin with. I mean, what can be more of a diplomatic question not related to the Secretary of Defense? And Carlucci agreed with Weinberg. And Reagan agreed with him. I want to say one thing, this comes to mind, and it's an interesting insight into George Schultz. Schultz, in presenting his case as to why Habib should be permitted to travel there, or sent to travel down there, completed his argument by saying, but I have to tell you, Mr. President, that Elliot Abrams disagrees with this advice. I don't know, you know, there aren't a lot of guys in Washington in that administration or any who would have done that. In any event, he lost. And the president said, no, And Secretary then said, in a tone of voice that can well be imagined, well, I think then that I will fire Phil, since he obviously has no use in this administration. It's, you know, one of those, whoa, okay. Now, that was a rare meeting in the Reagan administration. Might have been too rare in the sense that things were all too often covered over and not raised to the president. And the president was not forced to say, you win or you win, which at least gave very clear policy guidance that it did. And Phil, by the way, did quit after that. That kind of incident is the kind of thing that greatly embittered the Schultz-Weinberger relationship, that deepened the existing bitterness. I do want to say one thing that's related to this, because I think it goes back to this question of how Reagan's administration functioned. I said at the beginning, he was not his own prime minister. He delegated a lot. He was not, I thought, a very good administrator. Many things did work well, and I think one of the reasons they worked well was that he did give what I think I'll call ideological or political guidance. And in a sense, that conditioned many of the wars that took place within the administration at lower levels. On personnel issues, it meant, for example, I could hire Democrats because I could say, well, this guy is a Scoop Jackson-type Democrat, as I was then, this is a good fellow, and you would win on ideological grounds, even though the guy was a Democrat, or the woman was a Democrat. It meant that on an issue like Chile, you had to be careful how hard you pushed, because you had the sense, vibes almost, that the president wasn't fully with you. On Central America, it meant that you could push very hard indeed, because you knew the president really was with you. And in a sense, people understood that there were issues on which the president had strong views, and if ultimately decisions got to him, they knew how he would go. So that though he wasn't administering, and he never even heard about most of these, nevertheless, they came out the way he would have wanted them had he been an efficient administrator making 10,000 decisions a day.
Other questions? Could I ask one question, and you'll know that there's no malice. We've asked a couple questions about the good Elliot Abrams, but may I ask a question about the bad one? In terms of the principle of it, you really became the spokesman, and you were called on to debate Senator Dodds and people like that with a much longer public presence in American politics. Looking back, do you think, laying aside the right and wrong of the policy, the truth or non-truth, do you think the confrontation policy that perhaps you were forced to follow was the best policy in defending that program?
Yeah, I would have to say I do. I think first that the Democrats sought a confrontation on this issue. They had the opinion polls. They knew that the president's position was not popular among the populace. They knew that they therefore were not going to lose anything publicly by opposing him on this. Or they thought so, I think they were right. That was one thing that led them to push very hard. Secondly, this was a caucus issue for the Democrats. In both houses, the caucus consensus is to the left of the party nationally, particularly true in the House in those years. And the position of the party was pushed left by people in the caucus and pushed into, I think, a deliberately confrontational status. Now, the question then was, well, that's fine. The fact that they seek confrontation doesn't mean you give it to them. Seemed to me that we actually, in the end, we didn't lose anything. Now, we lost a lot because of the Iran-Contra scandal, which is a different question than the approach of political and rhetorical confrontation. Until Iran-Contra, I think we gained by it. because they were somewhat taken aback by the fierceness of the approach. In many cases, they'd never actually had an executive branch official tell them they did not know what they were talking about, and that their views were, you know, blind and dangerous. They didn't like it, but I think it weakened them until around time. Then, of course, the whole political the weight, the balance switched very much from the president's side to the Democrat side. I think Schultz, more than Haig or Vance, or certainly Baker, also didn't at all mind having assistant secretaries go out there. I was out, I think, more than Crocker, but Chet Crocker was a pretty good target for the Democrats, too, on South Africa. And Schultz didn't mind that and felt that these were people who probably handled the argument best. And the president certainly liked the confrontational policy. You can't prove a negative, I realize, that you know, had we tried a non-confrontational policy, it would have worked better. But I'd say, number one, until Iran Contra we were winning, remember that I came in August of 85, we won the $27 million, and then in 86 we won the $100 million. In 88, we lost getting another, I don't remember what it was, 25 or 30 million, by 4 votes after Iran-Contra. So I think had it not been for Iran-Contra, the confrontational policy would have paid off. But I would say something else. How is it that the good Elliott Abrams became the bad Elliott Abrams? And I would say that it was not a change of personality, it was a change of issues. The Democrats were not really seeking confrontation on human rights policy, but they were really seeking it on Central America.
I have one last question on this. Negatives don't always prove something. Does the positive of the Bush administration policy, which of course came at a different time in history and under different circumstances, but does that prove anything one way or another about the wisdom of your policy?
I don't think so, because, as I say, first of all, until the Iran-Contra, we actually won on the Hill. We won a lot of votes. And if you think about it, 10 years after Vietnam, a heavily Democratic Congress approves $100 million for a guerrilla war? That's really quite amazing. Secondly, the situation which the administration faced, I think, as you suggest, was quite different. The Russians, by then, were pushing the Sandinistas into an election. The election strategy was one we had used on occasion. We had used it in Chile, for example, with great success. And it's a terrific strategy, wherever you use it, because it's not just a strategy, it's for real. And the administration was very smart in using that strategy. The question there is, of course, whether they thought the Sandinistas would win. Were they really all that smart, or did they luck out? I think most of them probably thought the Sandinistas would win. Final answer, hold on. It's only 1990. Come back to me in 1992, Nicaragua would be a holy mess.
Could I ask just one last question? You worked for
Sorry.
You worked for three of the most striking political figures in American politics, in a way. Is there anything from the first two experiences that you have, by contrast or by similarity, which bears on the success and the strength of Reagan?
You're referring to Jackson, Moynihan, and
Reagan. Jackson and Moynihan and Reagan.
I want to make a strange analogy between Jackson and Reagan. Moynihan was completely different than in every way. Much smarter than the other two, much more educated and learned than the other two. much more difficult to get along with than the other two, and which created staff turmoil. That's a real problem. But that's really what I wanted to get to. There was an odd and almost eerie feeling for me, having worked for Scoop Jackson, watching the relationship that his closest advisors had for Reagan. Scoop was beloved to all of us who worked for him. But his vices were understood as well as his virtues. His limitations were understood. That is, for example, that he knew about some areas and not others. I mean, he knew a lot about the military side, a lot of domestic issues, economic issues. He didn't know much at all. None of us who worked for him believed that he had the kind of brilliant mind that Moynihan does. So on his staff, there was an interesting combination of love for the man and respect for the man and a slight sense of vulnerability on his behalf. That is, when he was giving interviews, for example, you're always a little bit worried, what if they ask him some economic question and he doesn't know the answer, he gives the wrong answer. There was always a sense of edginess that people who didn't love him, as we did, were going to try to trip him up. This never edged into, the lowest form would be contempt, disrespect. That's a better word. It never edged into disrespect because we worked for him, we worked with him, his staff in many cases had been with him 10, 20, 30 years. And it was a very human feeling. It really truly was a paternal feeling that many of us had for him. Watching the Reagan situation reminded me a little bit of that, because many of the people who were closest to him did love him, and they understood his limitations. And they were constantly edgy about him making mistakes and about protecting him from mistakes. Perhaps Mrs. Reagan being the foremost example of this. But there was a difference. The difference is that when you go from a scale of being just a senator to a president, not everybody around him loves him. You've got a lot of people around him who just want a meal ticket. We began to develop some of this when Scoop ran for president, because then you had new people who were just there because they thought he might win, or worse yet, they didn't care if he won, but they thought it might be good for their careers to be on the campaign staff for a while. Though the way the campaign went, that turned out not to be so great for anybody's career, but that's a different question. But with Reagan, of course, as president, you necessarily had a lot of people around who didn't know him at all. I mean, there wasn't any reason they should feel emotionally attached. They had hardly met him. In other cases, you had people who were really looking out for themselves. I think, in some cases, they did not respect him. They disrespected him. I felt that towards Haig by the end. Now, of course, by that time, you know, Haig was in big trouble and there was a lot of emotion involved, but I felt Haig did not respect the president, whereas Shultz did, always, even when he thought the president was wrong. And Shultz, when the president made a decision he thought was wrong, and Shultz, you know, extremely impassive, and one of us would say, "This is unbelievable, and I'm not here," and sort of rail for a minute, and he would sit there, and he would smile, and he would say, "Well, you need to get yourself elected president, and then you can make that decision." "I wasn't elected president, and I can't make that decision," he would say to us. And remind us of the special talents that the president had, which got him in that office. I'm struck by the number of people who surrounded the president who, as the thing, well, at least, you know, there's an example of somebody who did love the president and yet was pushed aside, by people who had no regard for him, but who were more effective as bureaucrats. Now, I don't know if there's any way around that. I mean, I don't think this was a problem that had a solution to it, and people weren't smart enough to find the solution. You changed the scale of the operation, and you therefore brought in people to whom the president's strengths were of less importance and to whom his weaknesses were more glaring. And It didn't happen really with Scoop. I've sometimes wondered if it would have happened had he been elected president and had we had to bring in people who'd never met him before. But I think it did happen to an appreciable degree by the end of the Reagan administration.
Well, we've kept you much longer than we normally do, but it's been to our benefit, and we certainly thank you very, very
You're
much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
I didn't know.